From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are Christian Science Monitor's Washington Bureau Chief Linda Feldman and VOA Senior National Affairs Correspondent Chris Simpkins. Welcome, Linda and Chris.
Hi, Kim.
Good to be with you, Kim.
Well, here are the issues. Senate Democrats say a major floor debate on gun control is inevitable after a mass shooting in Uvalde, Texas, left 19 children and two adults dead. In U.S. politics, Tuesday was another big night for primary elections in some states. For candidates endorsed by former President Trump, the night was mixed. And as a side note, it has been a record-setting year for the Republican Party in terms of African-American candidates. The National Republican Congressional Committee reports a record-setting 81 black candidates running in the 2022 primaries. During his Asia trip, President Biden vowed that Washington would stand with allies and partners to push for a free and open Indo-Pacific region. President Biden remarked at a press conference while on his Asia trip that the U.S. would defend Taiwan militarily if necessary. The statement garnered world attention and angered leaders in Beijing. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said he would be open to negotiations with Russia, but only direct talks with President Vladimir Putin. 2 years after George Floyd's murder by a Minneapolis police officer, the nation is struggling to deliver progress on a host of issues that include policing and inequality in American life. Well, those are the issues, and let's get started. President Biden has called on Americans to turn their pain into action after the deadly mass shooting at an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas, left a staggering 19 students and two teachers dead. So, Linda, there are so many discussions on this tragedy. There's the issue of making schools safer, the political debate over gun control, the mental health concerns, Facebook posts, they have the social media involved, and the human aspect of the loss of children and teachers and the pain their families are experiencing. So where do you start in terms of discussion and taking action?
It's one of those situations where it's, first of all, everybody, of course, has to take a moment to collect themselves. This is so, so awful. I mean, it's hard on everybody. It's hard on the journalists who cover this. I know somebody who covered a previous tragedy in Sutherland Springs, Texas, who couldn't cover the Uvalde massacre. In Washington, it has a terrible feeling of Groundhog Day, where you keep living the same day over and over again. These mass shootings keep happening, and you have the same people saying the same things. Some people are desperate for common sense gun control measures, nothing dramatic, nothing like confiscating weapons from people or banning the acquisition of firearms, but just things like universal background checks, perhaps raising the age of when someone can legally buy a weapon, which this 18-year-old did legally, even though he's legally wasn't allowed to drink alcohol. So it's easy to get discouraged and feel like there's nothing Congress can do. It isn't just the gun lobby, it's gun supporters. Even if the NRA went away, the National Rifle Association, there is still a very strong and dedicated portion of the Republican base that votes primarily on the Second Amendment, on the right to bear arms. And that's what senators and congressmen are afraid of. They're less afraid of the NRA than they used to be, but they are afraid of their own voters, even though a vast majority of Americans does want common sense solutions to this.
Chris, your take on this?
Well, I think it's going to be tough because what you have in Washington is really no common ground on what we should do legislatively to solve these problems. You have people and lawmakers on the far right who are against any kind of gun restrictive measures. You have people on the far left who says we need to get rid of all the guns. That's the problem, that there are more guns in this country than people. A report suggests that there are about 400 million firearms in this country for a population of about 331 million people. So in order for there to be some type of meaningful action in Congress on gun control legislation, which there has not been in pretty much three decades now, you're going to have to find some common ground. So we'll see. There are some senators who are trying to talk to some moderate Republicans to see where they can go on gun legislation and see if anything could get passed before the end of the year.
And I wanted to really just talk briefly on the psychological effect of continuously broadcasting these heinous crimes. And you kind of touched on it earlier, Linda, talking about how it's even hard on the journalists reporting these types of things. So how do you feel the media is handling these types of cases? I know we have a responsibility.
It's tough because on the one hand, you don't want to incentivize anybody else to do this. I know that the media avoid using the name of the shooter. They don't want these shooters to become somehow iconically viewed in certain circles. I don't understand how that could be, but I guess if some people want to die in a blaze of glory, they do a mass shooting and then their name is remembered. So I choose never to say the name of people who commit these heinous crimes. In terms of broader coverage, you know, you have to cover the pain and the tragedy. You have to write about the people who've died. We at the Monitor make an effort to also show the light and the humanity among the survivors and the help that's being given to them in terms of the love and support. I mean, these are people who have lost loved ones, some of them very young, in such tragic circumstances. And if, you know, if we didn't cover it, that would also be a problem.
And what I have noticed with the coverage is that there is a bigger emphasis on reporting about mental health, because in this tragic time, we're so distraught about what happened. The news media has given outlets for people to reach out to get help if they have mental health concerns, also trying to pinpoint if there are warning signs that we can detect with people before they act in this manner. I'm kind of heartened to see the news media reporting more on ways that we can discuss this with our children, ways that we can get mental health services to young people who might need them as a way to, you know, move forward with this tragic incident, but recognizing that mental health is a issue that we need to talk about more, and we need more outlets and promote outlets that can help people who may be struggling.
Yes, those are some very good points that you all have brought up. And also, in another aspect that, you know, was brought out in the reports of the shooter posting his actions on what he was going to do, and then after he did it on Facebook. What role does social media play in this?
It's unfortunately part of the problem in that social media is a platform for people to speak very broadly to the public and to whoever's paying attention. And we're having this very big debate over if or how to regulate social media. These are private companies that run these platforms, and so they're not technically in the public domain, and you can't say free speech. So they can be regulated, but it's impossible. I feel like that cat is out of the bag. We can't get rid of social media in the name of depriving potential killers of a platform.
I think there is a definite push for social media companies to do more. They say it's hard to track personal messages, and apparently the shooter was delivering a personal message of his actions to somebody else. But in broader senses, like chat rooms and things that are accessible to the public on social media, a lot of people are calling for these companies to do more monitoring and even blocking potentially dangerous sites and chat rooms before they have a chance to spread a message and possibly encourage other people to take harmful actions, like going out and carrying out a mass shooting.
Yes, absolutely. It's very sad and tragic, and our hearts go out to the families who lost a loved one in this violent, senseless act. Well, now to the most recent primaries. In a high-profile race, Georgia Governor Brian Kemp fended off a challenge by David Perdue in the Republican primary. And Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger won over another Trump-endorsed candidate, Congressperson Jody Heiss, to win the GOP nomination. What do the wins for the non-endorsed Trump candidates mean for the Republican Party?
It's a very interesting moment for the Republicans. It shows that Trump is not all powerful, and that oftentimes when voters are voting in local and statewide races, they have their own ideas about who they want. This wasn't fully just a rebuke of Donald Trump in voting for the incumbents. It's voters who live with these people, live with them as their leaders, and who have their own ideas and aren't necessarily going to do whatever Donald Trump tells them to do. I mean, Donald Trump has had lots of success and has been influential in some of the nominations. I mean, he did boost Herschel Walker, the Senate nominee, early on, and I think that gave him some juice. Trump was instrumental in the Ohio Senate primary with J.D. Vance. But even if Donald Trump personally isn't all powerful and people don't just do whatever he says, Trumpism is still very much alive and well. And Governor Kemp in Georgia, he made a point of saying that he's not anti-Trump. So he's trying to kind of have it both ways, that he upheld the law when he refused to find votes for Donald Trump after the 2020 election, but he's not anti-Trump. So I think that was sort of gave voters in Georgia permission to vote for Kemp, even though Donald Trump had endorsed the other candidate.
We have to remember, too, that this is a primary election. So the most hardened Republicans and Democrats tend to vote in these elections. But it'll be interesting to see in the November general election, when everybody's voting for these candidates, to see how Donald Trump's influence is going to be. And I think Georgia will be an interesting case because you've got a rematch set up in the gubernatorial race between incumbent Governor Kemp against Stacey Abrams. So it will be interesting to see if Trump's willing to do anything towards Kemp, or is he just going to stay neutral in this governor's race between Stacey Abrams and incumbent Governor Kemp. But I think for the other candidates, the non-aligned Trump candidates, I think it was more positive news for them than negative in these primary elections that we've had so far.
And also in Georgia, Herschel Walker and a Democratic U.S. Senator Raphael Warnock. This will mark the first time that two major party candidates for U.S. Senate in the state of Georgia are African American. So that was also an interesting twist.
Yeah, I think it's going to be hard for Herschel Walker facing up against the incumbent senator. We will see. But in a general election, you're probably going to have a higher African-American turnout. And even though both of these candidates are African-American, most African-Americans will be putting their support around Senator Warnock.
As I mentioned earlier in the intro, it's been a record-setting year for the Republican Party in terms of African-American candidates and primaries. So what is this really signaling to the world regarding their image?
Well, it just shows that the party gets it, that they need to be diverse. The Republican Party has increasingly been seen as the party of white people, and they have worked very, very hard to recruit people of color to run for these key positions. So I think they are having some success. And it's worth noting that Donald Trump actually did slightly better with black voters in 2020 than he did 4 years earlier. So it would be wrong to consider, you know, each party sort of monolithically one type of person.
And there has been some success with Republican African-American candidates. I think the party realizes, too, in order to win future elections, you will have to bring more African-Americans into the fold of the Republican Party. There's no doubt about it. There were really big pushes 20 years ago to try to enlist more African-Americans to get into the Republican Party. But in the last few years, that effort kind of stalled out, even though Donald Trump did get increased support over his two elections in African-American support. There has to be a bigger push. And I think the Republican Party realizes that. And I think that they are going to try to make more inroads into having more African-American candidates run under the Republican label. And hopefully that will increase by the 2024 election.
Yes, we'll have to see how this all works out. And it's time now for a quick break. And when we return, we'll examine some takeaways from President Biden's trip to Asia. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voaafrica.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype, Christian Science Monitor Washington Bureau Chief Linda Feldman and VOA Senior National Affairs Correspondent Chris Simpkins. Well, before we talk about President Biden's Asia trip, in news after his trip, North Korea fired three missiles on Wednesday, including one thought to be its largest intercontinental ballistic missile. In response to the missile launches, the U.S. and South Korea held combined live fire drills. So what message was North Korea trying to send after the president's trip?
This is Kim Jong-un basically saying, hey, look at me. The timing was obviously no accident. It was hours after Joe Biden had ended his trip to Asia. The focus right now in Asia is on the China-Taiwan situation. And this was just a little reminder from Mr. Kim that he is very much a player in the region because of his nuclear weapons.
I would agree, too, with Linda's comments that this was an opportunity for North Korea to do this at a time when the world is focused on other issues. And what it shows is that they're continuing to press forward with their development of the nuclear arsenal and ways to deliver that nuclear arsenal. And what I think this does, it makes it much more difficult to try to work with North Korea on limiting some of these advancements that they're trying to make and bring them back to a negotiating table where they will scale back their ambitious weapons programs.
And in looking at President Biden's statement that the U.S. would militarily support Taiwan if China was to invade Taiwan, it sparked criticism from Beijing, and U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken gave a major speech outlining U.S. policy towards China. Why did Biden's comments spark such criticism?
Because it was completely opposite to U.S. policy. The U.S. policy on the China-Taiwan situation is one of strategic ambiguity. And he has answered this question three times, and he always does this off the cuff, not in prepared remarks. So this isn't a considered policy. And furthermore, his own White House comes out soon after he makes these statements saying he will intervene militarily on behalf of Taiwan if China does invade. The White House then walks back the comment, which makes you wonder who in the White House is doing this. How is this happening? Is this happening with Joe Biden's permission or at least acquiescence? It's a very strange way to run a government. It's its own form of ambiguity, actually. The analysis of this goes all over the place. Some people think that Biden's comments encourage China to act to reclaim Taiwan, which it already believes is part of Greater China. Others think that this is a deterrent toward China, that given the situation in Ukraine, where Ukraine is not a member of NATO and therefore the U.S. and NATO forces will not have boots on the ground, the U.S. is worried that China is watching this and seeing that it might want to go into Taiwan sometime soon, or it could be a deterrent. I mean, there's a lot of moving parts here, and how China is reading Biden's comments and the situation in Ukraine could lead to numerous outcomes. We're kind of playing with fire here, and if the goal is to keep Taiwan safe and free, I'm not sure that Biden's saber rattling is the wisest move. But this is Joe Biden. He tells us what he thinks.
I think that Joe Biden's comments from the people that I've talked to have served more as a deterrent and letting China be on notice that this is what we'll do. China regards Taiwan as a renegade province, and the policy was for years that if Taiwan declared their independence, we would not support them militarily, but if China invaded on their own, we would provide military assistance. I mean, we've been arming Taiwan for years with defensive anti-missile technology to defend itself in case China did that. But the policy was more quiet years ago because China's military had not progressed to the state that it is now. China's military is much more powerful than it was years ago. And I think the U.S. and Biden were acknowledging that. And we've seen provocative action by Chinese military to reclaim islands in the South China Sea where they've placed military assets. So I think Biden wants to put China on notice that you cannot just go here and attack this country without any consequences from the United States.
And in looking at Ukraine, President Volodymyr Zelensky said he would be open to negotiations with Russia, but only direct talks with President Vladimir Putin. So what are Zelensky's hopes with this, and what would he have to give Putin?
Well, the official Ukrainian position is that they're not willing to give up anything. And furthermore, they want back the territory that Russia claimed in 2014. Russia annexed Crimea. Ukraine wants it back. Russia occupied portions of the Donbas in the east. Ukraine wants those back. Now, that's their opening bid. We're giving nothing. I think everybody knows that Ukraine is going to have to compromise if they're going to end this. But then that makes you wonder about Zelensky's longevity, because there are a lot of Ukrainians who won't abide any form of compromise with the Russians. I think this is a long shot to restart talks with Putin. The two sides are so far apart, and we can expect this war to drag on far into the future.
I agree. We are already in the fourth month of this war, and there continues to be fierce fighting in the Donbas region and a lot of more casualties. The thought is among some people that the longer this war draws on and keeps going, it's not in Ukraine's best interest. Even Henry Kissinger, the former U.S. Secretary of State, suggested that the Ukrainians come to some ceasefire talks with the idea of ceding territory, which we've talked about. Zelensky's just not willing to do. So there's really no path at the end of the tunnel that could bring these two sides together.
Yes, and we'll have to quickly move on to get our last topic in. This week marked the second anniversary of the death of George Floyd. Floyd was killed by a Minneapolis police officer in 2020, which sparked demonstrations and protests worldwide. Also this week, President Biden signed an executive order requiring new use of force rules for federal law enforcement and encouraging local police departments to make similar changes. So do you think local police departments will follow the federal changes, and how much will this help with policing on the local level?
I think it could go a long way. Each police department is different, and we have tens of thousands of different law enforcement agencies in this country. But I think there is now a concerted effort to change the situation. And even earlier this month, the Human Rights Commission in Minneapolis came out with a sweeping and scathing report about discriminatory policing practices at the Minneapolis Police Department, the department where a former officer was charged with murdering George Floyd here as we observe the second anniversary of his death. The Biden administration has tried to take some executive order action since there's police reform measures in Congress kind of stalled, but the changes are underway, I think, at police departments throughout the country in places like Louisville, Kentucky, and Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Baltimore, Maryland. Some analysts think that it will put more pressure on these police departments to recruit quality officers, establish a database where we can see if there were problems with officers so bad officers don't just move from police department and not do a good job in policing. So I think there's a lot of room to improve, but it's going to take some time.
Linda, last thoughts.
Chris stated the case very well, that even though President Biden can't directly tell local police departments what to do, certainly he can set the bar in terms of federal law enforcement. And we're at a really tough moment in policing in America. You've got, you know, those on the left who think we need fewer police because of how badly some behave. And I think the average American wants the police. They want to be able to call 911 and have somebody show up and be treated well and not have these horrific policing situations, which we see all too often.
Well said, both of you, and we'll have to end the show on that note. My thanks go to our panelists, Christian Science Monitor Washington Bureau Chief Linda Feldman and VOA Senior National Affairs Correspondent Chris Simpkins. I'm Kim Lewis, and on a programming note, our current affairs programs are on our new website at voaafrica.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. And thanks for listening to Issues in the News.